Welcome to another edition of Subversity here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the Regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. This is Dan Tsang with Subversity. Today we're going to talk about this explosive court decision yesterday, a bunch of court decisions, but we're focusing on affirmative action. And with us on the line is Professor Dana Takagi from UC Santa Cruz. Welcome, Dana.
Hey, thank you, Dan.
Yeah, what's your reaction to this decision, split decision yesterday?
Well, this is a terrific decision. I have to say that I think that, there's been a lot of uncertainty about how the court would move on the Michigan cases. And I think for all people who are supporters of affirmative action, this is a terrific decision. So this is celebration, I think.
It's better than you thought?
Well, it is better than I thought, because I think that particularly in the law school case, the court basically affirmed the Bakke decision and said that Bakke was, in effect, still the law of the land. And that's an important decision for big public universities as well as for selective private universities, because it basically says that race is a factor, can be a factor in a university admissions decisions. And as you know, here in California, race has not been a factor in university admissions decisions or in hiring or staff evaluations since, when was it, 1996, when the Regents passed SP1 and SP2. So this is a terrific, I think, victory.
Do you what were some of the wording that was used in the court decision that you that you think are significant?
Well, there's a couple things that struck me. I haven't read all of the opinion. I've read really the summary and the main opinion of the court. I haven't read the dissenting opinion on the law school case. And for those people who are, interested in reading such a thing, you have to sort of wade through quite a bit of legalese and the citing of other cases. But one of the things that struck me as I read the main court opinion for the law school was that they were very clear in saying that the state has what's called a compelling interest in educational diversity. And what that means is that if the federal government is supportive of kind of the principle of educational diversity, and by that they mean they are referring specifically to the racial diversity of institutions of higher education, then that means that also there can be policies that can address doing something about ensuring that there is racial diversity. So that was one thing that really, I think, stood out. And the other was that the court clarified, this is maybe a somewhat kind of more detailed point, kind of the standard for judicial review of race policies. And I don't know, we'll have to see exactly how that sort of gets worked out in university admissions. I think probably many admissions officers are still kind of puzzling over, okay, we can take race into account, but what is the way in which we can take race into account?
Why didn't, you would think that they would have snuck out and, I mean, taking the sneaky way out and use the California method.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, as I thought about it, I mean, there's been a lot of talk on my campus. There are a lot of people who study education and affirmative action, and we've been all sort of querying one another, saying, well, what do you think the court's going to do? And all of us have been saying the court could go either way. And I think ultimately the way the court went is they relied on previous Supreme Court legal precedent, which in this case is the 1978 Bakke decision. If they had wanted to side with the Bush administration and, kind of decide for the plaintiffs in this case, they would have had to have scrapped the 1978 Bakke decision. And I think maybe, it looks like a majority of the court in the law school case did not want to do that. They didn't feel that there was, in effect, legal grounds to do so.
So they kind of rejected the kind of quantitative ground, right, of giving a 20-point advantage.
Yes, that's the kind of crux or the heart of the ruling in the undergraduate admissions case. And, I haven't talked to very many people about this, but I do think that, my own opinion is that that's a good decision. And I know that might sound a little bit odd at first, so I should probably explain what I mean by that. The University of Michigan gave 20 points to an applicant if he or she were Black, Native American, or Latino. And I think one of the reasons I disagree with that, or I think that it's a reasonable ruling to vacate that part of the undergraduate admissions policy, is I think the spirit of Bakke would say that that is, in effect, a kind of quota. But more to the point, there's a way in which, there are lots of Asians, for example, who should perhaps be considered for a racial tip. And there are probably among Latinos and African Americans and Native Americans, perhaps, there are students who should not receive tips. So I think it doesn't really treat the individual applicant as an individual. So that's sort of my take on the 20-point issue. I mean, I didn't think there was any way that they were going to approve that. Court precedent at the district level has been pretty clear on that for the last 10 years or so.
So you're saying that even like don't you end up with a more vague kind of criteria than set of criteria?
You do. I think you
Yeah.
do.
And that's okay.
Well, that can go either way
Yeah.
depending on.
People's subjective kind of maybe prejudices even.
Yeah, that's,
Yeah.
it's really hard to control the evaluative judgments of admissions officers and admissions staff. And so, if the admissions office has a enjoys a lot of confidence, among the state population or the, the parents of applicants, then there's not going to be a problem.
Yeah.
But, one of the things is I did notice that the university cited Harvard's law school or undergraduate admissions policy again, which the court also did in Bakke back in 1978. And it's not a very transparent policy. You can't basically kind of add up your scores in your classes and say, okay, according to this, I'm a shoo-in. Whereas the University of California, for example, has had for many years that kind of a, like a scale or an index that allowed people to evaluate before they got the admissions letter saying that they were in or out. They could expect a particular kind of answer. And that's just, I think that's not a good way to run an admissions office because it doesn't, it admits people on the basis of typically very objective kind of criteria.
I think with I mean I've sat in on faculty senate meetings or committees, I mean, that give out awards and stuff and scholarships or whatever, and it seems like the tendency is to kind of there's numbers, you look at the numbers first because you kind of use numbers to screen out certain people, and that's kind of a almost an instinctive thing. I think people like they want as if the numbers mean anything,
Well,
I
we're
mean.
certainly a kind of a numbers, test-driven society in the sense that even among all of us who are very critical of the standardized tests,
Right.
Sometimes we can't help but be impressed when someone, plops down with a 780 or a, 99 percentile or something like that. And it's a very quick and easy way to make a decision. But, to really look at a whole, the whole individual, you have to look way beyond the test scores. Don't you think? I mean,
Yeah.
maybe I'm just.
I mean, that's why people look at essays, right? I
That's
mean,
right.
like admission essays and maybe even I don't know if there's a chance to interview people, but probably not at a big school like yours, like state school.
Yeah, certainly
Yeah.
not at the big public universities. Typically, there is not that. And for the most part, undergraduate admissions at the University of California, students are not supposed to send letters of recommendation.
Oh.
Those are considered to be, they're not looked at UC.
Did the court look at any other type of affirmative action, like for alumni, of private schools?
You know, I did not see any references to legacy tips, but I, based on what I've read so far, I think the court is well aware that there are all kinds of preferences that are being used at the university, athletic preferences,
mm-hmm.
legacy preferences, and so on. In fact, I'm scratching my head a little bit, but I heard a little bit of the oral argument whenever it was done, maybe about 6 weeks ago, and I remember thinking that, boy, the church did seem like the court was going to side with Michigan, at least in the law school case, because they were very, very critical of one of the people who was addressing the court, who was saying that racial preferences should never, under any
mm-hmm.
circumstances, be used.
Do you think because they're lawyers, they tended to take that position? They went to law school, you know, some of them were, you know, people of color, and you think that had anything to do with it?
You mean the Supreme Court justices?
Yeah, themselves.
Oh, gosh. Dan, I'm not so sure about that. I mean, I was just sort of looking at Justice Thomas's dissent on this, and he's quite adamant that that racial preferences should not be used. I don't know about that. I'm quite sure, you know, in the majority opinion of the court, they cite the amicus briefs that are written by or offered by military officials and
corporate
businesses. So I think, you know, it's quite likely that that had a big effect on the court.
Military officials and what? And
private
corporations.
Yeah. I don't know the whole. I can't remember offhand what the whole list of amicus briefs includes, but I do know that there's quite a who's who among private corporations, and I think I even heard General Schwarzkopf on the radio yesterday.
Right. Yeah.
So.
Do you think in terms of, would this affect anything in California now? That UC procedures.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think we'll have to wait and see. I'm hoping that it will affect things in California. As you know, right now the University of California is basically under the yoke of Proposition 209, so that we don't keep records on race and we don't admit people with any... by taking race or gender into account in university admissions.
I thought they keep records, no?
I think they're not supposed to.
That's...
I sat on the Admissions and Financial Aid Committee here at UC Santa Cruz a couple of years ago, and, you know, unless one reads an applicant's essay and one sees something about that a student was a member of the Black Student Union in high school or that... you know, he or she wanted to, was interested in African-American student affairs. I think that we don't keep track, at least here, of race background, so.
Huh, wow, that's interesting. So, I mean, how would this, I guess this, you think this would set back Ward Connolly's attempt to push this through the, you know, proposition process?
Yeah.
His initiative to ban the collection of race data, I guess.
Yeah. Here's what I hope. I hope there will be a lot of discussion about this in public forums and in the media, because what you find right now is that states like California, Washington, and Florida, all of which have a kind of Proposition 209 style initiative that has been passed by the voters. In some ways, the federal—it's you know, a much kind of stricter, narrower way to think about employment and admissions than the federal government really wants us to think about. Because I think the court is very clear that, you know, diversity is a compelling state interest, and so to the extent that for the rest of the nation. Diversity is a compelling state interest, but for California, you know, we don't take race into consideration. I'm hoping that, you know, people in California will begin to wonder, why is it that we are out of sync with the rest of the nation? So that, you know, I noticed, I logged on to the UC system-wide website to see what the president had to say about this, and he said two things. Basically, you know, we're very, as a supporter of affirmative action, I'm delighted by the Supreme Court's decision, and also a kind of reassurance that, you know, we at the university, I'm putting we in parentheses here, are following the letter of the law of Proposition 209. So it's an odd pairing, I think, and I'm hoping that the university will take the lead in rethinking whether or not following Proposition 209 is really necessary for us. I mean, it is, you know, sort of technically, legally, but let's face it, the rest of the nation is going to go a different way on this.
They can, I guess, move, the regions could pass another resolution, I guess.
That's right.
Retracting what they did.
They could. I'm not sure what kind of the legal issues would be, for example, if the regents, when they meet in July and August and through the fall, if they plan to take this up. But I'm hoping that the new president will think some about talking with the regents about this issue, because, you know, at the University of Texas, after the Hopwood decision back in, what was it, 1996, Texas is also a state that doesn't use race in university admissions. And basically, the Supreme Court decision yesterday swept away the Texas decision. So
that was a state, was that because of state law there, or?
That's right. Well, the district court basically ruled in favor of the plaintiff, who complained that the university had violated her Title VI rights in admissions policy, and the district court agreed. And my understanding is that the University of Texas did not appeal the ruling, in part because they were concerned that if the Supreme Court agreed with the district court, then that would basically wipe away affirmative action for the rest of the nation.
Oh, right.
And but at this point, where we stand is yesterday's decision wiped away the district court's decision in Texas.
Because they never appealed it, so.
That's right.
Right. Yeah.
That's right.
So
I think, and
I mean, this is precedent. Yeah.
I'm assuming the University of Texas will return to considering race as an admission in both undergraduate and professional school admissions.
Do you Well, had there been any kind of outbursts at Santa Cruz? I guess students aren't there.
Yeah, everybody's gone home for the summer.
we just started summer school, I guess, this week too. But
yeah.
Yeah, but nothing very active out here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, as you know, maybe the when the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in this case, there were pretty big demonstrations outside the court, and you know, I've heard many people, many of my colleagues say, well, the court's not going to make a decision until school is out to protect themselves. I don't know if that's true or not. Certainly they held this till the very end. That's clear.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
How does it, I guess, let's give out the number here. It's 949-824-5824. If you want to check it with our guest, Dana Takagi, who's the author of a book, actually 10 years ago on this issue, Retreat from Race. 824-5824, Erica 949, if you want to chat with her. The opinions expressed on the show are not necessarily those of the regents of University of California nor the management of KUCI. Given what you wrote in your book, does it change anything?
Does it change anything?
You wrote.
Well, you know, I wrote that book some time ago, and at the time, the reason I titled the book The Retreat from Race is I thought that administrators at the University of California in particular were taking the lead in moving away from, retreating from, the use of race in university admissions. And I think I was right about that. But I would not have anticipated then that the Supreme Court would make the decision that it did yesterday. And
you focused on, I mean, some of, I know in the book you focus on some of the kind of neoconservative strategies and tactics.
Yeah.
That seems to be still going on.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, many of the news articles that I've read about the decision yesterday or the announcement of the decision have been that, you know, liberals are claiming victory and conservatives are claiming victory. And but
well,
I think overall the victory is one for those who support some sort of state interest in diversity.
Because
and,
don't you
that
think
means racial preferences?
Yeah.
You know, that certainly that's included in there.
Don't you think the conservatives are really upset because they expected all these kind of right-wing justices to vote their way?
I think they did. I think they did.
They can't.
You know, I think I read an article by Linda Greenhouse, who's the New York Times.
Right, I saw that.
Legal Beagle. And what did she say? The court is moving to the right. And certainly on lots of other issues, civil rights issues, the court is moving to the right. But in this case, as I said, they chose to follow Supreme Court precedent. So, for better or worse, you know, I think it's a great thing that they did that.
In a funny way, it's like diversity is kind of mainstream now, right? Because you have all these corporate heads saying that we need people of color for to get jobs, to be hired.
That's right. I must say, I want to really applaud the University of Michigan for
standing up,
for standing up and taking it all the way to the Supreme Court. I wish that the University of California had done that many years ago.
Oh, right, right.
Because certainly they would have had an opportunity to do so had they pressed ahead by keeping race in.
Yeah.
And certainly, you know, the University of Texas could have done so as well. But by gathering interest in the case and also, you know, all of the amicus briefs that were written by the corporations, those, I think, clearly made a difference. And so, you know, we are in great debt to the University of Michigan for having the kind of the fortitude to take it to the court.
Do you think there's this, definitely, do you think there's going to be a move to include, like, other ways of, like, class-based kind of admission more than, you know, or what?
More than
more, I mean, more than just on race?
Oh, yeah. And, in fact, you know, I think, you know, that has been maybe not a very well-publicized part of university admissions, but certainly at the University of California, I think that admissions officers have been quite aware that there are schools that don't have AP courses, that there are students that come from working-class backgrounds who don't have the same advantages. And I think admissions officers face the same dilemmas when they try to think about how to evaluate students who have, you know, relatively fewer or lesser advantages than white middle-class students. And, you know, the trick is to devise or to think about a scheme that allows us to evaluate those students fairly.
First of all, you have to get the pool, right? I mean, that's why they're going to, they're broadening the range of schools that they go out, do outreach.
That's right. That's right. I think since the Hopwood decision and since SP1 and SP2 were originally passed and before they were rescinded, that was a decision that was made by the Office of the President at UC, which is that our best hope right now is to expand outreach and, you know, to do partnerships with K-12 programs that are going to prepare people to apply to the University of California. And certainly that's still very, very important.
And now they add, isn't it true that the top certain percent of every school now can go to UC systems, universities for different high schools in the state?
Yeah, this is the 4% plan or something like that. Yeah, I'm told that, or I have read a couple of articles, particularly in the San Francisco Chronicle, that have said that that has not made a dramatic difference.
Difference in the race or in the
In the diversity
oh yeah
of the student body that actually ends up at
end up
UC.
yeah yeah
But certainly the 4%, 10%, whatever percent plan has been touted around the country by various politicians as kind of the solution or the alternative to race preferences.
Are the right is the right arguing that too?
Yes, they are. They are. Or at least some are. It's an interesting conundrum. I think the right is so, frenzied about race that they would be unwilling to compare it to, for example, veterans benefits or legacy tips or athletic scholarships. I mean, college basketball as we know it would disappear if athletic preferences were done away with.
Probably even
So,
at Michigan.
probably even at Michigan, that's right. But, in the UC system, there, UCLA is a
Sports school.
terrific basketball
Yeah,
school. And,
definitely too.
yeah. So, one other comment that I just wanted to make about an interesting little quirk about this issue, affirmative action, is that in the opinion of the court that I read, they are definitely affirming a level of judicial review that's called strict scrutiny.
All right.
And I think you probably know this. I don't know if many of your audience listeners would know this, but that's a level of judicial review that was hatched during the Second World War in the having to do with the internment of Japanese Americans. And originally it was used as a defense for the internment of Japanese Americans, and it basically says that we would never use a racial classification unless it was a matter of national security. And
So it's like a raising the bar kind of
that's right.
higher standard.
That's right. It is the highest standard of review of a special classification. So, and this is, I think, the area that the people who are dissenting on the court will probably try to make more of in the next, if there is a next round of affirmative action cases, which is to say that, hey, this is, education is not a matter of national security. Although, one could reasonably argue that it is. And we'll have to let General Schwarzkopf make that argument, but
Maybe you could give us some history on how Asians never got dropped from the affirmative action category.
Oh, yes. This is an important part of the kind of history of affirmative action debate over the last 20 or so years. And one of the points that I made in my book is that I really think that affirmative action debate became much more heated again during the 1990s, in part because of the question of admission of Asians to the most selective universities. And it was Asian Americans who were arguing that universities, the top selective public and private universities, were discriminating against them
Right, they
by
were
having,
saying that.
right, ceilings or quotas on them. And
So there's a big split in the Asian American community.
well, I think, all of us at some level would like to think that when we apply to a school or we apply for a job, that we're seen as an individual and not as a race. And so I think you'll hear many an Asian American say, yeah, I don't believe in affirmative action, or I'm not supportive of that. And they could be saying that in part because they feel that they're not seen as a whole person or individual. Or they might be saying that because, in fact, Asians have not been included in affirmative action preferences for quite some time.
When was it dropped or changed?
Well, it was dropped and changed at in different places at different times.
Mm.
But pretty much through, I would say by about 1982, 1983, you begin to see universities rethinking whether or not Asians should be included as part of affirmative action. I think in Berkeley, for example, in 1985, 1986, somewhere around then, for example, I think the only Asian group that was kind of on the quote list as an underrepresented minority were Filipinos.
Mm-hmm.
So,
are they still on it or no?
Well, the University of California would say that we don't take race into account, so they would say no.
But you know that
Asians are such a diverse group.
I know. That's what I was going to suggest. It masks all the kind of intra ethnicity kind of race and ethnicity differences.
That's right. That's right. I mean, it is true that, you know, people that have been here for generations, in general, have a very different socioeconomic status and kind of list of educational advantages that are going to be different than more newly arrived immigrants, than people who live in poor enclaves of cities and rural areas. And there's tremendous disparity
definitely
among Asians. So, and you know, just to go back to that 20-point issue and the university undergraduate admissions, again, I think, you know, this is an issue that will benefit Asians who are often seen by university admissions officials as being, you know, that they don't need any kind of, you know, that the university official doesn't need to even think about the racial impact of being Asian American. And I'm hopeful that, you know, university officials will think about that because it makes a difference. It might not make a difference for someone like me who's a third generation Japanese American, but certainly for, you know, people that have arrived in the 1980s and the 1990s, people who come from immigrant families who are poor, and, you know, their parents are, you know, working 10, 12, 14-hour days in small businesses. This is really, you know, this should make a difference in their lives.
How about in terms of faculty? I mean, how does this relate to faculty hire? You know, I know that we've had, like, what, target of opportunity programs at UC and other programs to encourage more kind of diverse faculty, especially in fields where they are not that prevalent.
Right.
And is that, I mean, that's still going on, right, the UC system, right?
Well, I think the university still has a faculty initiative that's called something like the Target of Excellence.
Ah.
And the old TOP programs were, what were they called, Target of Opportunity hires? I should know because I myself was one. Were phased out after SP1 and SP2 were passed by the regents in the middle of the 90s. And they were phased out, I think, because they tended to be gender and race. I mean, they took into account the fact that, you know, there aren't that many women in engineering, or that there were not that many African Americans in this field or that field.
Right.
And the university phased that program out, but they kept the Target of Excellence program, which is designed to recruit particularly outstanding faculty in whatever field, literature, chemistry, the social sciences, the humanities. That's a good question. I mean, you're asking, what about these programs?
That's the impact, I guess, of this decision, yeah.
The impact of the decision, it depends on how the University of California reacts to this. On the one hand, one could argue that, well, this is a decision about undergraduate education and about professional school or graduate level admissions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not very, you know, it doesn't have anything to say about faculty hiring per se. But if one were to follow the spirit of the court decision yesterday, clearly it would be that faculty diversity is a compelling state interest as well.
Because I know that, you know, different affirmative action offices used to prod different departments to, you know, they would clear different hires or different processes.
Right.
But now they don't seem to do that much anymore.
No.
Even
and
though it's, we're still subject to federal law, right, as a state. I mean, because we get federal monies.
That's right. And that's sort of the weird, you know, in-between place that the University of California has been in since Proposition 209 passed, which is that we're not allowed to promote or hire people or admit people on the basis of or taking into account race or gender. But on the other hand, you know, we're a public institution that receives federal funds, and that means that we're subject to federal guidelines about affirmative action.
And we still report, you know, statistics.
That's right. That's right.
To the feds, yeah.
That's right. So it's a very peculiar position, and I suppose that university administrators must feel as if they have to comply with federal, you know, standards on the one hand, but they are also have to be responsive to the electorate in California. And
yeah.
It's sort of like the federal government is saying one thing, and
yeah.
the electorate is saying another thing. And as I said earlier, you know, I think it's our job, those of us who work at the university, to take the lead, in effect, in educating the electorate about this.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Because to be in compliance with the federal government, you know, it shouldn't be like this kind of backdoor embarrassing thing that the university does. It should be something that we do sort of proudly.
Well, I guess the next battle would be the Ward Connolly initiative that I guess will go to the voters on whether to collect race data.
Yeah. I'll be interested in what he has to say now that the court has passed this.
They've been actually on campus right before the end of the school year. They were soliciting, they actually had a black person there soliciting signatures right in front of the library.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, setting up a table for,
yeah.
for a few days and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
it's hard to say how, I mean, I'm not surprised that Ward Connerly and his supporters can find members of minority groups to lobby, you know, for the initiative. But as I say, I think the only antidote for that is to have lots of talk. And
do you know if there's any exemption, on his initiative for like social science research, if you want to collect that information for like statistical reasons, or is that totally also not allowed?
Oh, I hadn't even thought about that, Dan.
I mean,
that, you know, that our right as researchers is to collect that sort of data. I think it's for administrative record keeping purposes that we're not allowed to keep that data. And yeah.
Maybe
I don't know.
Yeah.
I wonder if maybe someone, one of your listeners, might know that.
I think that I saw some op-ed a few months ago in which there's another bill in this is a bill in the state legislature in which was trying to get maybe children to opt out, either opt out or opt in. I forget which one. I think it was the opt out of any surveys that were being passed out in school. So they're trying to stop it at that level in terms of at the beginning, at the collection level, that they don't have to answer these things, and you have to get their permission before you can get the parents' permission, basically, I guess. Yeah.
Wow. You know, we've come to this really odd place in the kind of world of race relations in which, on the one hand, we're not supposed to pay attention to it, and on the other hand, even though we're not supposed to pay attention to it, we're doing nothing but thinking about it. So,
do you think we'll come to the day where, like, Paul Gilroy was on the show before with Glenn Memura,
uh-huh.
and we're talking about his book, was it Beyond Race?
Yes.
And
yes.
I mean, we talk a lot about race, but we all kind of want to go beyond it too.
That's right. That's right. Well, I think, Paul Gilroy is a very kind of anti-essentialist intellectual. And when he says we should go beyond race, I think he's talking about a particular kind of ethical humanism in which, we value each other as members of a larger group. And in a way, that's not so much different, at least on the surface, from what neoconservatives are saying. Except that neoconservatives have a tremendous number of inconsistencies about the kinds of arguments that they make about race. I mean, there's almost a kind of meanness that's attached to the arguments that they make about race.
Because I asked him about that, about the Connolly Initiative also at the time, and he was saying his vision doesn't mean you should not fight racism.
Right.
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 I mean, there's still racism, so.
Yeah. And that's part of the, I think the kind of, I don't know what to call it, I'd say it's kind of a political and moral battle or struggle that many of us have to take up, which is to kind of make that distinction between when we talk about race and the issue of racism. Because I think for many people, if you even mention race, like you say, oh, I saw, this movie that was done by a black filmmaker, that they will, to them, that's racist. The very fact that you say someone is black.
That you just mention it.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, in a way, all of the dialogue and debate that we're having about, should we keep racial records? Can we take race into account? The big elephant that's standing in the room with us is the question of racism. And
right.
We're not talking about that,
Right.
We're not talking about that.
How about this whole issue of HAPA identity, mixed race identity? I read some data from this new book about the census results, and they argue basically that by the next census, the number of Asians who are of white and Asian kind of parentage or mixed Asian parentage will be the largest group, even larger than Chinese, which is right now is the largest. If you count, people from Hawaii and all
when
over
you say
the
largest US. Group, you mean largest portion of the Asian population? Yeah.
Right. And so, and this is a big change, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a huge change.
And so how would, would it be a voluntary thing, how you identify as? I guess it's always voluntary.
Yeah, it's always voluntary. And I think, we've seen this really sort of quick, rapid set of changes that that classificatory systems have a lot of trouble dealing with. Like, you have to check, one box or another. And, how will admissions officials deal with the fact that someone is multiracial? Or, is a mix of two different races. That's very unclear. I mean, my sense is that admissions officers already, to some extent,
put you in boxes, right?
Right, that's right. And I would imagine that they evaluate, for example, someone who is black and white somewhat differently than someone who is black and Asian. And so on. So I think whatever ideas that we have about the so-called, compact categories, discrete categories of race, probably get translated somewhat to the multiracial category.
There's still a hierarchy.
Probably.
Yeah.
That would be my guess. Although, these things are very unconscious things, I think. You know what I mean? So that admissions officers or students or faculty...
they might not know, I suppose.
Outside the university, we carry around a lot of ideas about race that are we can't articulate exactly what those ideas are.
Well, in terms of admissions, they probably wouldn't know, right? Unless it's written down somewhere.
That's right.
That you're of mixed parentage, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Because they don't, students don't send in their picture, do they? when they apply.
At one time, students did send in pictures of their admissions applications, but they don't do so at UC anymore.
Some schools they do, huh? Still,
yes,
I think.
I believe they do, yes.
Oh, wow.
I believe they do, yes. So,
Do they ask, do people ever listen to tapes, or do people send videos of themselves or anything as a part of the process?
Not I
that you
imagine
see.
That some students who, for example, have done documentaries
oh, yeah,
or
creative.
Films or
performance
know,
art
want
things.
To submit a piece of performance, that they might well send tapes.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't exactly know what the university undergraduate admissions rules are.
Like for fine arts programs or something, huh? That might make sense, I guess.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, especially for grad school, then definitely. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And in fact, you know, part of the distinction that it's important to make is that undergraduate admissions are really different than graduate admissions.
Yeah, definitely.
And in a way, I think the ruling is saying that the way in which we do graduate admissions is a more narrowly tailored method for taking race into account than the way undergraduate admissions proceed. Because so many big schools like Texas, Michigan, the University of California, they have some sort of, you know, rating system that they use to process thousands and thousands of applications. They don't have, I mean, we honestly, particularly now since the budget cuts are about to kind of more completely descend on us, we don't have the funds to
do outreach.
Well, I was going to say not so much outreach as to have like two or three people read every admissions, every applicant's file.
Yeah,
that's a tough go when you know each campus is getting 19, 20, 50,000 applications. So,
but in terms of actual impact, you think? I mean. Is graduate education very diverse? I don't see it that much, you know, in terms of some fields, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, UCI is a good example. We have, you know, thousands of, a huge percentage of Asians in the undergraduate programs.
Uh-huh.
But if you go to certain disciplines, it's almost zero at the grad school level.
Yeah, that's right. And it's a good indicator that the faculty who are reviewing applications, who are the faculty that the, you know, the admitted people will be working with, you know, carry with them certain emphases in their own work that might or might not recognize, you know, the importance of diversity in the graduate class. It's a, I mean, some of it is, you know, committees are, what they're really dependent on, you know, who walks up and applauds.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, there's nothing about the evaluative process at the graduate level that is going to ensure diversity. Do you know what I'm saying?
Right.
Just as there's nothing about the undergraduate process that's going to ensure that you won't get in trouble with the court. But I think, at least in principle, I think the court is saying that when you look at each individual application, you evaluate each individual as a person who comes with grades, test scores, letters, their essay, and, you know, whatever so-called, you know, supplemental criteria in terms of school activities or church activities or whatever, that is something that is in keeping with federal law. So, and that's, you know, that's more like what we do for graduate students. So, but as I say, there's no guarantee that itself will produce a more diverse class. I think you're quite right about that. So
it's also a process. I mean, a factor of mentoring, right? For the faculty to mentor seniors or undergrads and get them to go into grad school.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, I have to say that many years that I've been a faculty person, I have been a little bit slow to realize that I could actually pick someone out of a 200-person class. You know, it's increasingly difficult to do that because we're teaching larger and larger classes at the university. But, you know, that it's really our job to pick outstanding students out and say, hey, are you interested in going to graduate school? This is what I was thinking based on what I've read of your work and seen of your exams and so on. You know, you have a talent for A, B, and C. And a lot of students, you know, will say, I don't know what I'm going to do after school.
Mm-hmm.
if they don't get the encouragement or the nod from faculty who notice that they're doing good work. So it's a there's a you know obviously the court decision is not going to solve the many different levels of the ways in which you know selective criteria function at the university and the way we judge students and the way we encourage students and so on, but it's at least, you know, we're not going backwards at the moment, which is where we seem to be going with affirmative action for the last, oh, I don't know, 8 or 9 years
yeah.
or so.
Since your book came out. But, so you predicted it. But the but now it's a reversal. But I mean, a cynical way of looking at the decision, though, would be to argue that, don't you think that you could argue that because all these corporate leaders endorse this, it's just another indication of the kind of corporate nature of the university.
Yeah.
That we're here to kind of, you know, to create, I mean, to churn out people for the for
right.
the for the globalization.
For Microsoft. And,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I certainly, I have been wondering about how to think about this, about the fact that, you know, perhaps the right way to think about the court decision is that they made the decision that they did because they can't say no to the military or to Microsoft. Well,
but it still is beneficial.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, I could sort of go both ways on that. Do you know what I mean? Because
right.
On the one hand, what is Microsoft's interest, or what is the military's interest in making this argument? I mean, the military, to be sure, is really the first, you know, form of affirmative action at the federal level.
The integrated.
Yeah. Yeah. What is their interest? Is it that they need the bodies, or?
More
yeah,
labor,
more labor,
more skilled labor.
Yeah.
Again, skilled labor, because they want you to go to university.
Yeah. Yeah. Well.
Definitely.
It's. I mean, we can only speculate about that.
Well, I guess then the onus is on the faculty who are here to give them other options. I guess. I mean,
yeah.
People need jobs, but they also need. You know, it would be nice to sprinkle some social justice in there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, if you think about it, that Microsoft would write an amicus brief for Michigan, we could sort of discount the whole Michigan case on the basis of that. Or you could think, well, why is it that,
uh-huh.
you know, Microsoft is willing to do that? Why is it that, you know, how is it that they're really thinking about diversity?
Because it doesn't want trouble in the streets.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, wants, you know, people to get along.
Yeah.
Yeah. So people
sure.
will buy things, you know, buy computers.
Yeah. For sure. Well,
for sure.
Like I say, I'm of different opinions. I mean, about that. I mean,
yeah.
I do think that, you know, large corporations, many of the big ones, have fairly well developed diversity training programs.
Definitely.
You probably see more people of color working side by side with not people of color,
uh-huh.
In some of the big corporations than you're going to see integrated lunchrooms at the university. So, which is not to say that they, you know, have the key for how things work, but certainly it's in their interest that blacks and whites and Asians and Latinos and Native Americans and whites get along at the workplace.
Oh, for sure.
So.
Yeah, yeah. So,
yeah.
So, but even Bush is endorsing, like, you know, diversity, right?
Yeah. Well, diversity is one of those words that nobody's against it, right? It's just
yeah.
sort of your what's included in diversity, and to what extent we would go. To what extent we would go to maintain diversity.
I guess the Klan might be against it, but, you know, some of those groups.
Yeah, the Klan.
Yeah.
I don't know, the Klan's gotten a little bit more mainstream, haven't they?
That's true.
they might even support it.
Ah.
Yeah.
That's scary.
Yeah.
But you know, in Canada they have a different term, right? It's, I mean, they have this, I mean, it's national policy for cultural diversity or whatever they call it
That's
over there
right.
in Canada.
That's right.
And
Certainly,
yeah.
Canada, Australia, New Zealand,
Yeah.
Sweden, a number of countries have, cultural diversity policies that make it a matter of kind of national interest.
Yeah.
And maybe in a very small way, we moved half a step forward toward that
Yeah.
with the court ruling yesterday. As I say, the best news is that we haven't moved backward, I think.
So two steps forward, maybe one step back at some
Yeah,
point, yeah.
that's right.
So
There's
the
a.
next battle might be the Supreme Court justice too, also that they're considering
That's right.
to fill in. And so the right is also upset now over some of the candidates, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that Sandra Day O'Connor is she hasn't done exactly what the right has thought she should be doing
Oh, for sure.
in various decisions, including this one. So,
Well, I want to end on the note that I just picked up your book, I mean, from the shelf here, and it is totally
Dusted
dog-eared.
it off,
It's
yeah.
totally dog-eared. So at least somebody's reading
Yeah,
it. A 10th anniversary. You need to come up with a sequel.
I have to say, if I were to write another epilogue for the book, it would be that things were looking pretty bleak, and just yesterday they got a little bit brighter. So,
Ah, that's a
yeah.
good comment. Yeah. Well, thank you very much. We're actually over time. So,
Okay.
thank you,
Okay.
Dana, for doing
Nice
this at the
talking to
last
you,
minute.
Daniel.
Take
Okay.
care.
Bye-bye.
I'll keep in touch. Bye. That was Dana Takagi, formerly of UC Irvine in sociology back in 1986, and now a professor at UC Santa Cruz, who's the author of a book called Retreat from Race about affirmative action that came out 10 years ago. So today we were talking about the Supreme Court decision on affirmative action. This is Dan Zhang signing off with Subversity. This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.